Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and thank you for joining me on this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Pope Benedict reiterates his commitment to the search for full and visible unity of Christians. Anglicans and Catholics prepare for the visit of the Archbishop of Canterbury to the Vatican. And as the UN marks International Children's Day, we hear how young children are increasingly falling prey to the deadly phenomenon of human trafficking. Welcome to the program. Ecumenism, or relations between the different Christian denominations, is at the top of Pope Benedict's agenda over the next 2 weeks. On Tuesday, the Archbishop of Canterbury and head of the Worldwide Anglican Communion arrives in Rome for talks with the Pope and top Vatican officials. Then the following week, Pope Benedict takes off for Turkey on a four-day visit aimed principally at strengthening ties with the Orthodox world through a meeting with the Ecumenical Patriarch in Istanbul, Bartholomew I. These and other ecumenical issues were also the focus of a meeting last week of the Vatican's Council for the Promotion of Christian Unity. On Friday, the Pope addressed Council members, reaffirming his own personal commitment to the search for full and visible unity of the Church, as spelt out 40 years ago in the Second Vatican Council document, Unitatis Redintegratio.
Il Concilio Vaticano II considerò come uno dei suoi principali intenti il ristabilimento della piena unità fra tutti i cristiani. E questo anche il mio intento.
While underlining the enormous progress in ecumenical relations that has taken place over the past four decades, Pope Benedict also spoke of the new difficulties that have arisen recently, especially over ethical issues. He called for a more in-depth reflection on Christian anthropology, as well as on the concrete application of biblical interpretation.
C'è bisogno proprio da questo punto di vista di un approfondito dialogo sull'antropologia cristiana.
Those difficulties over ethical issues, in particular attitudes towards homosexuality, which are threatening to fracture the Anglican Communion, are likely to be on the agenda as the Pope meets with the Archbishop of Canterbury this Thursday. I asked the head of the Vatican's Council for Christian Unity, Cardinal Walter Kasper, what he hopes may come out of this important meeting.
Well, my hope is that we can continue with the dialogue because the Anglican Communion is not only England, it's not only the United States, it's everywhere where the English Empire was all about. It's in all the world, more or less. And therefore it's very important for us, and many Anglican provinces are still very close to us in Africa, Asia, and in Oceania. Surely we have to speak about the new problems, and these are also ethical problems. We belong to our faith, and I think we have to talk about these problems. We had already a common document about moral problems, and perhaps we can re-elaborate this document. This is one point, but we have not made any decision up to now. We can make this decision only together. Probably we will establish first a small commission which reflects the problems, which reflects the possibilities and the new quality of the dialogue, and then only we can come to a final decision.
Pope Benedict is talking about his commitment to this goal of full visible unity, and yet you yourself said earlier this year to the House of Bishops that if the Church of England ordains women to the episcopate, this goal of full union looks almost impossible.
Yeah, of course, because we cannot have a full communion with a church or ecclesial community which has women bishops. That's not possible for the Catholic Church. It's not possible also for the Orthodox churches, and it's not possible for all churches of the first millennium. And we are very sad about this, because with the Anglican Communion we share not only 1,000 years, not only the first millennium, 1,500 years we share with them, and we hope that they can keep this common line with Rome and the Anglican Church, or the Christianity in the UK, the United Kingdom, was also founded from Rome on, and so we hope we can strengthen again this common tradition and common heritage.
Some people are talking about the possibility of an Archic III. What is your view on that?
Yeah, well, probably we come to an Archic III. We are both decided more or less to do it. But the question is only what will be the concrete phase, the concrete structure, the concrete theme of Archic III, and who will then belong to the Anglican community. This nobody can tell us at this moment.
Cardinal Walter Kasper, head of the Vatican's Council for the Promotion of Christian Unity. Years on from the Second Vatican Council and the establishment of an Anglican centre here in Rome, Archbishop Rowan Williams will meet with Pope Benedict to discuss the current state of the Anglican-Catholic dialogue, a relationship some experts describe as a wait-and-see phase of the journey.
Yes, I think wait-and-see is the right phrase for this moment.
Father Bill Franklin has been involved with the Anglican-Catholic dialogue in the United States since the 1980s and serves as a governor of the Anglican Centre here in Rome. He explains the background to this delicate moment of the dialogue.
The visit commemorates the 1966 visit of Archbishop Michael Ramsay, the first visit of an Archbishop of Canterbury to the Pope since the Reformation. And in the course of those visits, the two churches declared that the goal of their relationship is full communion, meaning interchangeability of sacraments and ordained ministers. And there's been remarkable progress toward that goal in official statements of the two churches, leading to agreement on the nature of the Eucharist and agreement on the nature of ordained ministry. However, recently, two issues have arisen which cast a doubt over the possibility of this goal of full communion. In June 2006, Cardinal Kasper flew to England to speak to the House of Bishops of the Church of England, and he said that if the Church of England moves toward the introduction of women into the episcopate in the Church of England, this goal of full communion would not be possible, and the temperature of the relationship would grow, in his words, much cooler. The wait and see is the question of whether, in fact, the Church of England will move in this direction. It's not yet evident that there are enough votes in the General Synod of the Church of England, in fact, to introduce women as bishops. Another issue is that on November the 4th this year, the Episcopal Church in the United States installed as its primate the first woman primate in the Anglican Communion, the Most Reverend Catherine Jeffert Shorey. Part of the wait and see is how will other churches respond to the elevation of a woman to be the primate of a church of the Anglican Communion in the Episcopal Church, which has been ordaining women since 1988. Wait and see. A second major issue concerns the future structure of the Anglican Communion. The problem here is that in 2003, the Episcopal Church in the United States elected and then consecrated as a bishop the first openly gay man living in a same-sex relationship with another man. This action of consecrating Bishop Gene Robinson as a bishop led to some churches of the Anglican Communion declaring that they were no longer in full communion with the Episcopal Church. In 2004, Archbishop Rowan Williams asked the communion to assemble a commission, the Lambeth Commission, to study the future coherence of the communion. And in October 2004, this commission issued the Windsor Report, which is a blueprint for a future of the Anglican Communion in which churches would act much more interdependently rather than independently. The Roman Catholic Church and the Vatican have been very positive about the structure of Anglicanism proposed in the Windsor Report. The wait and see is the question of whether all the member churches of the Anglican Communion themselves will accept this Windsor Report as their blueprint for the future.
The Church is one foundation, is Jesus Christ. The ecumenical enterprise is one in which we have got to continue searching for new ways of relating.
Marist Father Fred Bliss coordinates the ecumenical program at the Angelicum University here in Rome. He's just written a book called Anglicans in Rome, and he believes now is the time to consolidate all the progress of the past 40 years.
After all, the dialogue began in the 1960s. Archic 2 concluded just last year. We're hoping that there's going to be a move into the future when the Archbishop comes to Rome and meets with the Pope in the next few days, that there'll be the opening towards the Archic 3. And so that there's always that hope. There's never an ending to the relationship. It's a question of deepening what our baptismal relationship means, of deepening our understanding of the Eucharist, of deepening what our understanding of the Church is. And for both of us, we're still on a journey into understanding those significant areas of ecclesiastical life.
Many people still see, perhaps within both churches, see ecumenism as a kind of specialist area. Is this true, do you think?
Well, I think like any of the ecclesiastical sciences, you need some people who are specialists. But ecumenism is about the unity of the Church. And if it's about the unity of the Church, then that is something we've all got to strive for. And so it's very important then for priests to preach on the subject, to explain to people that there are areas in which we can act cooperatively and join together in as many ways as we possibly can. It's got to become part of the pews and not just become part of the desk and seminaries and universities.
And yet there is a sense in some areas that whereas, for example, in the 80s, after Pope John Paul's visit to Great Britain, there was a sense of a real united search, perhaps, for this coming together. Now there's almost a growing mistrust, perhaps, certainly much less enthusiasm for this important work.
Yes, I wouldn't say so much mistrust, but I would say there has been a lessening in the enthusiasm. And the reason being is that people are confused, that if we have got these two churches with their self-understandings so firmly established, and especially the Catholic position of being opposed to women priests and the ordination of a gay bishop and so on, then it does make it difficult to keep the enthusiasm alive. After all, we do live in an age of instant solutions to things. And if we're told that solutions may be 50, 100 years or more down the track, we say, well, it's a bit difficult to wait that long.
What is your message, if you like, to people who are interested in this dialogue, in this journey together?
The great discovery I have made in the research I've done in Rome here is to discover the great importance of friendship and of trust. And this was established firmly with people like Cardinal Bayer, Cardinal Willebrands, and with the various prelates who came from Canterbury to visit here, and bishops who used to come together. Catholic and Anglican bishops would come on joint visits to Rome, because as Bishop Baycroft told me once, he was once formerly a director of the centre, he said, Rome is also our home. And if we can all see that, and understand that there are great treasures that we have in common, then we can now, in friendship, learn more how to share them.
You mentioned, in the light of this 40th anniversary, the Archbishop of Canterbury coming here to visit Pope Benedict in just a few days' time.
Yes.
What really are your hopes and expectations from this visit?
I would hope that there would be some level of healing of the problems that have occurred within recent times, and we know that we can't expect miracles, but we want to maintain the bridges in place. And so we don't want any cessation of a relationship. We want to get direction from the church leadership as to how we can now proceed into the future in a profitable way. And so we want a new insight into the kind of ecumenism that can help us relate one with the other. And I do have hopes We're dealing with two very able people, Benedict and Archbishop Williams, both very capable people, have a long history of relating with other church communities, and I'm quite sure that they will at least give us a lead in the direction of a continued relationship, and a relationship in which there's going to be some positive input of a dialogue kind. In other words, hopefully an archic three.
My hope for the meeting is that the leaders will say, in the wait and see period, let us find a way to keep the dialogue going, to make sure that the relationships which were established in the 20th century do not evolve back into polemic. One of the great achievements of the 20th century was to create institutional instruments of dialogue, like the Pontifical Council in the Vatican, like the Anglican Center in Rome, which allow close relationships in the city of Rome, dialogue to continue. But how will the two leaders create an atmosphere and an inspiration for this dialogue to go on? I'm hopeful they will be, because of their own personalities, because of their own experience with monastic spirituality, which looks to forms of Christian and human unity, which has inspired both of them personally. So my hope for the meeting is that there will be a call for renewal of the dialogue, even as there's an honest facing of a new context remaining to be faced by the two churches together.
You remain very optimistic, don't you, despite these difficulties that we're talking about. What is it really that gives you most hope at the moment?
Well, part of the hope, I think, comes from the track record of these visits of Pope and Archbishop of Canterbury. For 40 years, on a regular basis, our leaders have been meeting. And that gives us a sense that the polemic of the past has now been replaced by an atmosphere of serenity and cordiality. Given the great abilities of the two leaders that will meet this week, and as a Christian, I believe the presence of the Holy Spirit in these meetings, I'm convinced that out of this chemistry of history, spirit, and leaders will become a call to a new birth of an attempt to keep the hope of Christian unity alive.
My thanks there to Anglican theologian Bill Franklin and to Marist Father Fred Bliss. And here on Vatican Radio, we will, of course, be following the Archbishop of Canterbury's visit to Rome throughout this coming week. It's a global phenomenon that in the last decade has reached epidemic proportions. From remote villages in the Himalayas to Eastern European cities, more and more people, especially women and girls, are falling victim to human traffickers. Often they are lured by the prospect of a well-paid job as a domestic servant, a waitress, a farm or factory worker, and they are recruited through advertisements, mail-order bride catalogues, and casual acquaintances. When it comes to minors, they are often sold by unsuspecting parents who are tricked into believing their offspring are going to be looked after, learn a trade or be properly educated. Sadly, most of these girls end up being forced to work as sex slaves. So what is being done to combat this growing phenomenon, and what are the churches doing to help? My colleague Susie Hodges picks up the story.
Many children around the world are falling victim to the prey of human traffickers. Nobody knows for sure the number of minors who end up being trafficked, but what's certain is that no country is immune from this mushrooming trade in vulnerable human beings. Poverty and unemployment are two of the key factors that fuel trafficking by creating a supply of potential victims seeking to migrate to more affluent areas of the globe. Trafficking is believed to be growing fastest in Central and Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. Katerina Cherepaka is the coordinator in Ukraine of an international NGO called La Strada that campaigns against trafficking in minors and provides help to victims. She says whilst no firm figures are available, estimates in her own country of the number of those who are trafficked range from 500,000 upwards.
It's difficult to give you the numbers. Unfortunately, there is no common or general statistical data within the country, and I'm afraid this is similar to other countries as well. Because, well, it's very difficult to count or to estimate how many those who cross the border become victims of trafficking. How many people become victims of trafficking within the country? How many of those who return, whether they're registered somewhere or not, so it's very difficult. Anyway, there are different figures that were announced. For example, according to the statistical data of the Ombudsman of Verkhovna Rada of Ukraine, there was about 500,000 to 700,000 suffered persons, trafficked persons.
It must be a difficult problem to combat, though, because it's poverty that's driving this trade, isn't it, really?
Well, yeah, the economical reason is one of the main reasons for this phenomenon. But this is actually, I would say, more often this is a kind of combination of reasons that also things that are contributing to the trafficking situation. This is both economical situation, sometimes domestic violence, lack of information. I would say the really normal wish of a person to see other countries or to visit other countries, but without being informed, being prepared, a person became very vulnerable for being trafficked. So actually this is a combination of reasons, but the economical situation is one of the most, and you know, you can find it almost in every case of trafficking.
ECPAT is a global network of organizations that campaign against child prostitution, child pornography, and trafficking of children for sexual purposes. Its executive director is Carmen Madrinan, and she says all three of these phenomena are increasingly interlinked.
Well, we don't have firm statistics. I don't think there's any organization that would be able to provide you exact numbers, largely because it is an underground criminal activity, so you cannot enumerate. We do know, though, that, for example, when you look at the number of images of sexual exploitation of children, for example, in child pornography, that there are millions of images of that abuse. And what we're finding through the trafficking project is that there is a great deal of interconnectivity between crimes. For example, a child may be trafficked so that they can be sold in prostitution, and also so that images of that abuse can be documented and then sold through the internet.
Jerry Pachter says once the victims have been tricked and fall into the hands of the traffickers, their rights and freedom effectively disappear.
I would say that the cases of kidnapping is rather rare, really. And more often this is the misleading, given the false promises. And, you know, when the person comes to the country, the situation is completely different from what was promised. And they had to do, they have no rights, they have no choices to go back because the documents, money, everything is taken away. They use this as an additional threat toward the person, that you are illegal here, you will be taken to the prison. And also they threat to make some damage to the family of that person, because very often, and actually almost in all cases, they know from what family, from what city the person came.
And do they actually sometimes use physical violence to force these girls to do what they have to do?
I would say they often use the physical and violence, physical and psychological violence. This is an integral part of this business.
But are we making gains in the battle against the traffickers of children, who can earn huge profits from their criminal trade? Madrinan believes governments around the world almost invariably could be a lot more proactive in trying to combat this problem.
I think that states invariably can do more. It varies from country to country, region to region. What we see is that where governments are active, it can make a difference. But unfortunately, that is yet to be seen across the world. And since we're an international organization, ECPAT would probably say that not enough is being done by the state.
And when it comes to the role of the Catholic Church and other religious organizations, Cherry Pachter says they provide valuable assistance in the campaign against trafficking in the Ukraine.
We cooperate with Caritas, divisions of the Caritas. We also cooperate with organization run by Ukrainian Orthodox Church. This is a very also good good cooperation because, for example, for the western part of Ukraine, the connection to the church and to the religion is more common and more widespread comparing to the south and the central part of Ukraine. And within these regions, our partners that are located in this region, they are very closely cooperate with the church. So they disseminate the information in the church. They give them the informational message to the those people who visit, who comes to church. So this is also very important. We do it, and we plan to develop it and to continue this kind of cooperation.
But what would be the typical profile of an adult who is seeking to exploit a child for sexual purposes? Madrinan says often these people don't fit into any obvious category.
I think that the abusers are, the profile of the abuser is that we have certain subsets of abusers that we know about. For example, child sex tourists, people that travel from one part to another because they know that in that area they're not known and that they can engage in illicit sexual crimes without being detected. But what we do know that is very, very troubling is that that is a very small percentage of the total number of abusers, that most of the abusers are local people exploiting children for sex. And that is, I think, what's very difficult for us in any country to come to grips with.
Thailand and other countries in that area of Asia have long been associated with the plague of child prostitution. And there is a flourishing trade in foreign tourists who travel to those countries for the express purpose of having sex with minors. FACE, or FACE, is a Thai organisation that was formed to fight against child exploitation. Its director is Sudarak Seriwat, and she told me that often when tourists are on holiday, they feel anonymous and as a result, no longer bound by the normal moral codes that would govern their behaviour at home.
You see, that is the normal mentality of any tourist from the industrialised country. When they work hard the whole year, save the money, they think that during that holiday, they can have rights to enjoy their lives, spend the money, and so on. So they do like that. That is the mentality. And also, other thing is that when they go away from their own social norm, nobody know who they are. They can be judges. In our case, some judges, university professor. Once they are in Thailand, in Cambodia, in Vietnam, they are Mr. X and Mr. Y. Nobody know who they are. Nobody know about their status, which they may not do some nasty thing in their own country because people may know. In other country, in the third world country, far away, nobody know about him. Of course, we have a program to produce a pamphlet to inform them, and we warn them that, okay, sex with children is a crime. So we quote the law to say and tell them the penalty. And this pamphlet is not targeted to them, but we target the ordinary tourists who may witness or see somebody take a child into their own room can call us saying that there is something happened next door.
So, but basically you're saying as far as the tourists are concerned, they don't really see that what they're doing is wrong.
I don't think so. I think this is a kind of sickness.
Thanks there to Susie Hodges for that report. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, for today. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.